This is the Criminal Law Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 3, April 4, 1967, 1 p.m., Room 4445, State Agriculture Building. Today's subject, Amendments to Responsibility, Preliminary Draft Number 4, In Court Crimes, Preliminary Draft Number 1.
Section 4 and 5, I think, are strictly technical adjustments in language suggested by the commission because
sure,
it wasn't exactly clear that the
amendments here.
That the notice had to be given of intent with regard to the general provision set out in Section 6. So this is just, I think, more of a technical correction to reflect the clear intent of the notice provisions. And unless there's some question about it, I'd move on past those two.
Mm-hmm. Even on the partial responsibility, where he's going to introduce any expert testimony, he's got to give notice also.
The commission didn't approve anything, but they didn't disapprove the policy. The objection was to the language was inadequate to cover the hooking it up with the notice requirement. Now, let's see, Section 7. This is the section which should cause most of the trouble this afternoon and probably again in the commission. I did quite a bit of work after we had the discussion about self-incrimination, especially. And the suggestion in the commission, as I recall, was that we consider dropping the, by and large, most of the provisions in here or redrafting. However, on reconsideration, I felt that the approach was perhaps the correct one. Now let's see if I'm on the right sections here. Yeah,
Section 7.
I did make a change in the language of subparagraph 2 to eliminate some language that was extraneous, but the policy still is the same, and that is that subparagraph 1 reflects the Phillips case, which gives the state a right to have a psychiatrist appointed. And subsection 2 reflects what I now am more convinced is the proper constitutional view, and I'll sum it up as briefly as I can. Shepherd versus Bowe brought this subsection 2 into prominence here in Oregon with respect to the insanity hearing, not the incompetency to proceed, but the examination by the state psychiatrist to determine prior to trial what the mental state was on the issue of insanity. And Shepherd versus Bowe said that the psychiatrist may not ask questions, in effect, may not ask questions about at or near the time of the crime on grounds of Fifth Amendment self-incrimination right. Now, on reexamination of that, I decided that it's appropriate to leave the language there. And I would also extend it now, though I don't believe I have in this draft, to the incompetency section. Although the Shepherd versus Bowe did not involve the incompetency hearing, I think that as a logical and reasonable extension of the self-incrimination rule, a defendant who is forced to submit to the court psychiatrist's examination on the question of incompetency may refuse to answer questions that may tend to incriminate him. Now, it's not the same kind of a hearing in the sense. It's an incompetency to proceed. There's no issue of criminality involved in this particular hearing. But the conclusion I come to rests upon the United States Supreme Court's cases, beginning with most recently Molloy versus Hogan, which you probably know applies the Fifth Amendment through the 14th to the states for the first time, clearly, and that was 3 or 4 years ago. But Molloy versus Hogan, even more importantly and more crucially, also imposes the federal standards with respect to self-incrimination, which means that all the cases decided by the Supreme Court on the question must apply, I believe now, logically, in the extension I'm reasoning from the Hogan case. And an examination of the cases on Fifth Amendment over the past few years indicate, sum up again, and I can't absolutely prove this, and here again we're talking about what we think is the answer, that a defendant has almost uninhibited right to refuse to answer questions. There is in all kinds of investigations, whether it's a criminal case, and certainly more so in that, or whether it's a legislative inquiry, and perhaps even into the area now of private or civil proceedings with respect to license applications and that sort of thing. But at any rate, I'm reasonably certain that self-incrimination standards of the federally imposed rules through Molloy will now have the effect, or do now have the effect, certainly in all states, of enabling the defendant to refuse to answer questions which may not only incriminate him, but which may link up with evidence that it ultimately does incriminate him. There is the phrase, it's got to be some kind of reasonable connection, but the effect of the cases that I read is that the defendant
link
himself
the
is pretty well going to decide. Beg your pardon?
Link in the chain.
Yeah. And the only question would be whether a court has the right to decide whether it's not the link in the chain. In the cases there that I've seen, the federal United States Supreme Court cases, point out that the problem there is that if you start having the defendant tell the court why it isn't a link in the chain, he in effect has to testify all the self-incriminating information to arrive at his conclusion of why what he doesn't want to say here will be incriminating way down the line here. So the result, in the best of my judgment, but here again, no direct holding, only by analogy, very strong cases, I think, will apply the Fifth Amendment in a full panoply of rights to defendants in this kind of a proceeding. Now, this is going to have far-reaching... Shepherd versus Bow, I think, really does that. It's only on the insanity question, but I don't see how you can logically resist the conclusion, and it also applies on the incompetency hearing, because it's so closely intertwined with the question of criminality, self-incrimination.
Well,
that's a very brief and perhaps overgeneralized summary of the problem.
Well, we wait till we get to that section on the latter part of it, because that's the
Section
11.
Yeah. What I in the conclusion now specifically is that I've left the language, which I think reflects the Shepherd case and the Molloy and the federal cases, as it pretty much was before the commission decided they weren't happy with that approach. The effect being that it recognizes that the defendant may refuse the state psychiatrist where the answer may incriminate him. And I think clearly he's entitled to have an attorney present, and I think no policy was established on the defendant and psychiatrist, but the Shepherd versus Bow case, by clear implication, acknowledges the right of the defendant to have his attorney present, because in fact the trial court did prohibit the attorney from interfering with any questions, and by the Supreme Court saying you may not do what you did, I think this is clear implication that the attorney may be present. Well, the Fifth Amendment right doesn't mean anything unless there is a counsel present, really. Now, I don't think Frank likes this particularly.
No,
in fact, Frank is going to split a capillary over there. Let him talk about it.
If you can read Shepherd versus Bow differently, why I'm glad that.
I'd like to know how you read Shepherd versus Bow in any way and feel that there's any indication that he has a right to have a psychiatrist present during this.
Well, I don't insist that so at all. That question.
And also having the attorney present, of course, I disagree with that, but I disagree. Really, with the psychiatrist being present, it gets down to be a courtroom battle between psychiatrists anyway, and it's my feeling, maybe I'm wrong, that most psychiatric interviews are pretty nebulous as far as being able to, for them being able to really come up with any conclusions, which they do. And when you get another psychiatrist sitting there, it really, I think we just as well almost do away with the state having a right to the psychiatric examination in the first place there.
Well, of course, I agree with you, what you say about the psychiatrist.
I tried to call a couple who I've used in cases this morning, but there's some conference going on up in Seattle, and I think most of the psychiatrists in the state are going, but they just have to fight back and forth at each other continually anyway, and when you give one side the advantage of having the psychiatrist right there to give the other attorney questions to poke at him, I think you can make a farce of any psychiatric examination if you're actually there. And this is the reason basically why I object to having the attorney present too, is that you can just make a farce out of it.
Well, with respect to the issue of the psychiatrist, the commission was silent with respect to that particular issue. It was sent back because of the Fifth Amendment problem, and you know, as a reminder, this committee has already approved the psychiatrist's presence. Now, you can certainly change your mind, but that was not the issue that the commission sent it back for. I just thought I'd refresh your memory about that.
I would like to, just as a grammatical matter, make a suggestion as to subsection 1, gets a little bit away from the Fifth Amendment problem. The language you have added reads, if the defendant objects to the psychiatrist chosen by the state, the defendant may raise his objection before the court, and for good cause shown, the court may direct the state to select a different psychiatrist. It seems to me that the words, the defendant may raise his objection before the court, and for good cause shown, are unnecessary, because if the defendant objects to the psychiatrist, he obviously does so for the appointing court. And could we not simply have agreed, if the defendant objects to the psychiatrist chosen by the state, comma, and then the court, for good cause shown, may direct the state to select a different psychiatrist? Would that accomplish the thing?
Sure. As far as I'm concerned, that certainly.
Does anybody have any objection to that change?
Well,
purely mechanical. In other words, how does a defendant object to it? Obviously, he objects to it by so stating to the court, when the court says, well, I'll appoint Dr. Campbell. Or if a written order comes out saying Dr. Campbell is hereby appointed, he files an objection. Obviously, he files it with the court. Then the court, for good cause shown, may require a different one to be appointed. But it simply seemed to me that this wording would, the alternate wording would be cleaner and accomplish the same result.
Jim, we go back for a moment to some of the substantive things. First of all, I'm wondering, why do we lock psychiatrists in? Can a clinical psychologist give his opinion as to competency?
We have some legislative history on that very point in the comment, and we state in the history that a psychiatrist is meant to include all related scientific fields, psychologists, clinical psychologists,
the
and so forth.
Psychiatrist, as part of his examination, wants to have a psychological examination.
It was a feeling the commission that this would accomplish without unduly complicating the language of the provisions where a psychiatrist is referred to.
Well, secondly, and probably more importantly, I think really the entire provision for the state's psychiatric examination is completely impractical. If the attorney representing the defendant can't make a complete farce out of the examination, if he hasn't done his job, if you have a psychiatrist and the attorney standing by, you might as well put it in a courtroom. Mm-hmm. Have the judge conduct a hearing, because you're going to have constant objections, I would think, as to the links mm-hmm. getting to the ultimate fact. I think it's just completely unworkable. Frank, what would you do as a prosecutor in this?
If I could... you mean under this situation?
Under this situation, this procedure.
As a practical matter, we had right after the Shepherd case, it may have even been before the Shepherd case came down, where we filed a motion for the psychiatric examination under Phillips. Before that, we couldn't even get a psychiatric examination, although in some counties they did, but we couldn't. So we got the psychiatric examination. They in turn filed a motion directing that the attorney be present, that they be allowed to tape record it, that not be required to answer any questions that might incriminate. And so what Judge Mengler did was said, all right, you can't tape record it. I don't believe that their motion included having a psychiatrist present, but I don't believe even they thought of that. But the judge ordered that the attorney could be near.
Not one county away?
No. Not
the river.
Not in the...
Or up the river.
In the room outside while the psychiatrist was taking the history on all the other stuff that he does. But when the psychiatrist started to ask him about the day in question, then the attorney had a right to be present during this. While he's asking him about, his feelings on in other words, in our case, what it amounted to is from when he got up in the morning, really. And so, as a practitioner, this is what happened then. The attorney was out in the other room. As soon as the psychiatrist got to that point, he went out, got the attorney, came in, and then asked him the question, I think, well, how did you feel when you got up that morning? And the attorney instructed him not to answer, and from that point on, there was no psychiatric. So what we were faced with was that we did have better than just having the hypothetical situation, in that the psychiatrist had actually talked to him and gone through some of this past history. But as far as the actual commission of the crime and these acts, what he may have done and this type of thing, we were back with the hypothetical question. But it did give some weight to our psychiatric testimony, in that the psychiatrist had actually talked to him. I don't see, when you put in there that the defendant, when examined by state psychiatrist, shall not be required to answer any questions, the answer to which might tend to incriminate him. When you're talking about a psychiatric exam, any answer he gives that psychiatrist at all may tend to incriminate him by showing he's sane.
And Shepherd versus Bowles said
no. No, but I agree in principle with what you say, that the... That the and I think that's in fact what the United States Supreme Court's said, that you may not ask him if he doesn't want to answer anything. But Dave, I was going to say one more step. I'd agree with what you said about the attorneys certainly being present would make a shambles of the hearing. I think I'd go one step further. Now, since I've drafted this, I've done a lot of thinking about it. I'd go one step further and perhaps not even mention the right of the state to have an exam. Recognizing that within the Fifth Amendment cases in the United States Supreme Court, it has said that the state may serve process to bring a defendant, for instance, before a grand jury. Although the defendant is going to take the Fifth all the way, he may still be forced to come in and sit down in the chair, and at that point say, I refuse to answer on the grounds. So actually, I think really all we have left, if I read the cases right, and I certainly could be incorrect about it, all the state has left is a chair, an empty chair that they can now force the defendant to sit in long enough for his attorney at his elbow. I don't think he can even be excluded from the room, certainly not in the Miranda kind of case. It wouldn't be proper once he's insisted on counsel. But at any rate, all the state can say is that we'll bring you in and make you sit down, but then they don't get anything else.
Well,
how about a completely...
Are there Supreme Court cases on this area?
No.
U.S. Supreme Court cases?
No, not on the insanity area. No.
No.
But there are so many over a wide range, even of non-criminal cases, where an investigative proceeding by a legislative body, for instance, with no criminal charges whatsoever, the Fifth Amendment extends clearly to those cases. Well, now, certainly, this is a criminal case we're talking about. There's no doubt about the, what's behind the thing, why we're asking this defendant these questions about his mental makeup. It's criminal. It's a criminal proceeding, and the stronger case is there for the application of the Fifth.
Now, why... I recognize that there's authority and there's a case. I can't think what the situation involved with is that... I mean, clearly a person can waive a constitutional right if they know about it. Now, the Supreme Court, though, has said that you can't, I guess, in effect, has said that you can't force a man to elect between two constitutional rights. Do you recall what the situation
is? That's the Griffin case, where he's, if he remains silent and doesn't contradict the evidence against him, the court instructed about it and mentioned the fact.
Well, I think
it's what he says on a search and seizure hearing.
Right. Later
yes.
Trial.
Is Griffin the one where there's a presumption of criminal intent?
Yeah. But I can't see what is wrong. Of course, I can't agree with a lot of the cases, maybe, but I can't see what's wrong. But if the defendant wants to place his sanity, his responsibility of an issue by the calling of psychiatrists, I cannot see why he then shouldn't waive his right to remain silent to do this. But of course, I'm in a different...
In the statutory...
I mean, as far as being... as far as having to submit to a psychiatric examination.
Let me go back and approach it from an entirely different basis than what we're doing here. And I think it hinges on one question. Is it required by the Constitution that the determination of competency is a fact which must be found by a jury?
No, the
court does that. It's not the
it's
jury business at all.
Presumption of competence. Every person is presumed to be...
Why don't we just go completely back? We're talking about... Or insanity. Well, let's talk about insanity. Why not go back and make it a question of medical condition? Maybe you can go so far as to, if the defendant elects to interpose this defense, to set up a board of arbitration, one psychiatrist chosen by the state, one by the defendant, and those two choose a third, make the report to the court. If the report is that the man's not responsible, and if you stop right there, if the finding is that he is responsible, then this is a privileged communication, I would assume.
You're talking about the issue of insanity at the time of the commission of the crime, not ability to assist.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it would be a denial of jury trial.
Well, this is what it hinges on.
Yeah, Dave, here again, you were not sitting when we discussed these earlier, and I'm not being critical in making these remarks, but we did examine the impartial expert approach. It's used elsewhere. But I think that the subcommittee, and I believe the commission, has pretty much decided against that. There are some real drawbacks to that. One of which is that I think of right offhand, there's an extensive comment on the in the original draft on the section involved about the impartial experts. But when you get an impartial board, it has been the observation that it is unduly prejudicial to the defendant. The jury will believe that board because it's the court's board. And there's no reasonable reason for it other than the fact that it's impartial, and if it comes in and says he's insane, there's just no recourse for him. Because it's the court's man that's saying this, so they say, well, he's impartial, he's an umpire. But psychiatry is just too inexact for that kind of a holding. There are just too many different orientations and schools of psychiatry to have that kind of an imposing decision imposed on the jury.
Well, but is insanity at the time that commissioned the act a question of fact which must be determined by the jury?
Well,
it takes care of the whole thing there. So.
Well, I don't, I mean, I suspect that, I mean, you could say that it had to be, but,
How can you say, for example, that we'll try everything but venue to the jury, and we try venue to the court, or criminal intent?
No, it's a matter of due process. jury.
Or the question of justification for it, you know. Well, thing you take that from the jury.
What it seems to me that we, I mean, I know we discussed this some. It was the bifurcated trial. That if you have the trial on the issue that he committed the act, and then so there's no question then any longer as far as, you know, the commission of the act.
You mean that he killed the man?
Yes.
What about justification in self-defense?
Well, of course, that's got to come in at the trial. I mean, except for the part of partial responsibility, which would get psychiatric testimony into the first trial. You could have the first trial to determine that issue. Then from that point on, he's got nothing that would tend to incriminate him as far as talking completely to the state psychiatrist as well as the defense psychiatrist. And then you could have a full psychiatric examination of him and come back and try the issue of his responsibility.
I'll remind you again that we did examine this at length, and the California system of bifurcated trials has failed miserably. You cannot, California has found, you cannot separate the two. You can't separate guilt from proving the act. Because when you speak of proving the commission of the act, you've got to talk about mens rea. And when you talk about mens rea, anything of the mental characteristics of that person is relevant. And in short, you have to try it over twice, because the defense is going to bring in all his insanity or partial responsibility defenses just as well at the first trial as he will at the second. This is one of the reasons why it just simply hasn't worked, and there's been a distinct shift away in this country from the bifurcated trial. Now, I can see the point. I wish it would work, but I don't see within our concepts of mens rea how it can do it. It just doesn't fit either.
The alternative, if this is the alternative, I think is practically impossible. As a practical matter.
George, let me ask you this. Do you read Shepherd versus Bowe specifically to require, to prevent an attorney to be present?
Not specifically, no.
No.
Well,
but I think it's, my feeling is it's inescapable the way that the facts came up in the order of the court. Especially in light of the Fifth Amendment cases of the United States Supreme Court, coupled with the right to counsel.
Yeah, but none of the Fifth Amendment cases of the Supreme Court have been in this particular area.
As far as I know.
We can have hope, at least, that the Supreme Court may do a little retrenching, and it'll be a while before they ran that down our throat. I don't know. Maybe the way to solve the problem is this. Remember, we talked about not having anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
You mean not any kind of a hearing?
No, but not having any kind of a section.
Oh, yeah,
at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, if we have just the first sentence, we clearly don't go beyond the central specific holding of Shepherd versus Bowe. Now, what about leaving the second sentence out? And if the court comes along, either our court or the U.S. Supreme Court comes along and in a specific case says, no, by God, you've got to let him have a lawyer, okay, then
it gets changed.
Pro tanto amended, and away we go. But
are you talking about subsection 2, Jim?
Yeah, right. You can make all kinds of arguments about why you shouldn't have a lawyer there and why you shouldn't have a psychiatrist there and so on. I don't know. Maybe that's cutting and running in a way, but really, this isn't the law yet, and there's fairly good reason to urge that it ought not to be the law in the absence of a mandatory requirement on Fifth Amendment grounds. So, perhaps the best thing to do is to take out the second sentence. And then if either court wants to come along and say, well, you've got to have it, okay, you've got to have it. Maybe that's the solution. I don't know.
Well, with all deference to the court, Your Honor, I disagree with the conclusion of law, but I do agree in the sense that elimination of the last sentence would perhaps solve our problems, but I don't think it would make the law any different. I suppose what I'm saying is that I think that this commission, my feeling is this commission ought to establish the policy that I now reflect in this draft, and that is extending the Fifth Amendment with far-reaching implications into these areas of forced examination of defendants. That's really what we're talking about, forcing the defendant to sit down someplace and answer a governmental agency.
This is, you know, true, we argue a lot of philosophy here and so on, and I'm sure we should, but I think you can make a good argument that to the extent that he wants to run a rinky-dink, namely by this phony psychiatric defense, that to that extent, then he's got to play within the rules of the barnyard, which one of which is, okay, give the rinky-dink on the other side a shot at it. That's not really an assertion.
How do you spell rinky-dink?
D-I-N-K. But to the extent that, in other words, to the extent that you say that to a guy, okay, tell me about your childhood, and the attorney sitting there says, don't answer, it's incriminating. Sure, he can make a big fat argument that it's incriminating because from that the psychiatrist, along with other things, can conclude that he was mentally responsible. And therefore you're forcing him out of his own lips to give the testimony that defeats him in court, or convicts him in court. But really, that's, historically, that's a far cry from what the framers ever had in when they wrote the Fifth Amendment. They were talking about taking that tongs and going after you to tell your story in the Star Chamber and all that business. Now, I'm not so sure that we ought to establish as a policy this further extension of a doctrine that if extended in this area will clearly upset the fairness of the adversary system. I mean, what the heck? If a defendant says, I'm insane, I was insane at the time, and here's my head shrinker who says so, and he's examined me to the eyeballs, and he can tell you all about it, and the other guy wants to come in and say, gee, let me examine. Oh, no, Fifth Amendment. You know, that's a long ways from what the framers really meant when they wrote the Fifth Amendment. And I'm not so sure, as a matter of policy, that we ought to extend it that far. Maybe sooner or later we're going to have to when the court tells us. We didn't think maybe we had to extend that far until Shepard versus Bowe. Of course, we've got it. We can't do anything about it.
Maybe I'm an optimist, but I keep hoping that someday the United States Supreme Court might back up a little bit. And I'd hate to have something codified here that...
Well, that wouldn't make any difference. If the court backs up, that would undo the codification.
Well, no, it wouldn't.
No, it wouldn't. Not in Oregon. The law would be.
Shepard versus Bowe is state law as well as federal law.
Well, if the... you were talking about the U.S. Supreme backing up on the Fifth Amendment? Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. I'm with you. I agree. Well, it is an interesting philosophical point, and I think it's more than an academic point when we're talking about the Fifth Amendment. I agree with you in the sense that the Fifth Amendment is aimed at coercion, but I don't agree with the view that it's the whole third degree that it's limited to. Clearly, the cases have moved away from that long psychological coercion area, and that's what this is. It's a psychological compulsion. It's not physical compulsion in any sense of the word, nor is Miranda in those cases. It goes to the psychological compulsion of forcing a citizen, probably a criminal, to sit down and answer a government agent's questions. And the basic thrust, as I read them, of these United States Supreme Court cases now is that you may not do that to the citizen. You just cannot force, the government may not force itself on a citizen, not only in criminal matters, but in almost all matters. They haven't quite gone the complete way but I think the direction is pretty clear.
Parenthetically, I might mention, I just had a case yesterday, or the day before yesterday, in which a guy was appealing the suspension of his broker's, real estate broker's license, and the transcript testimony before the real estate commissioner, after the commissioner's witnesses were put on, then the assistant AG said, "All right, now, Mr. Hoop-de-doo, would you please stand and be sworn?" So he swears him and said, "All right, now you can make any statement that you want to make." His attorney, the suspended broker's attorney, argued vehemently that the whole hearing was invalidated because the broker had not been advised of his right not to testify against himself, and pointed to the 990 section of the code, saying violation of this code is can be punished criminally. And I said, "Do you have any cases on it?" And he said, "No, but I'll find some." So I don't know whether to find it or not. But he made that assertion in a real estate broker suspension.
Yeah, he may have something there.
I don't know.
Parenthetic. See, I don't want to get on Frank's list, but I still, I take the position that the Fifth Amendment is, it's already settled as far as Oregon is concerned by the United States Supreme Court.
Don, do you have any comment or?
Well, I tend to agree with your position that there's a matter of fairness involved, and that I wouldn't want to see us go that far either and write it into the code.
I agree that it's a matter of fairness, but I think the fairness is least represented by the code. Well, there we are.
Well,
and I don't have a vote, I might add.
Well, that's a question about the fairness. What really bothers me is the nuts and bolts practicality of it. Well, I think this could be used also as a great discovery tool.
Didn't the psychiatrist as much as say when they were here for the commission meeting that day that having the attorney there really isn't very workable, and that if the attorney kept objecting, that they wouldn't even try to conduct the examination.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
It's okay to have an attorney there if he sits quietly, but
if he doesn't assert his client's rights.
Yeah, right.
It becomes a penalty for them.
Yeah.
Well, then what you end up having is exactly the case you just mentioned. There's the fellow says, "I'm insane." His people get up and say, his psychiatrist gets up and say he's insane, but you have nothing from the other side.
Right.
Don't count that at all.
Let me respond. There are three big things that the state still has. Cross-examination, which is very important. Even if you haven't got a psychiatric expert of your own to take the stand on direct, it's very effective with a jury to cross-examine the living hell out of a defense psychiatrist who probably has never found anybody sane. There's all kinds of reasons that you can destroy the witness on the other side. Secondly, you've got the right, it's established here in Oregon and in most other places, to have your psychiatrist sit in the courtroom, observe the defendant during the trial, listen to all the evidence, and answer hypothetical questions based on that evidence and based on your man's observation of the defendant. He can then come to a direct conclusion of insanity if that's the way it is. But the third thing, and the biggest of all, is the jury, the trier of the fact, doesn't have to listen to one word of the defense psychiatrist's testimony, because it's not a medical question, and this was brought out very recently in this Massachusetts case where two psychiatrists testified for the defendant that he was absolutely insane. No testimony of any kind of the other way, and except perhaps a little on cross-examination, and the jury found the man sane and convicted him. The Supreme Court of Massachusetts affirmed, saying this, the medical question is not involved. This is a legal question for the jury to decide, and if it wants to find him insane, it may do so, despite the expert testimony. And you got this panoply still going for the state.
Let me ask you this, and I think we covered this before.
So if the crime is heinous enough, they'll...
Oh, that's right. The jury isn't going to listen to these doctors anyhow. You know good and well, Frank, they don't find people insane unless the guy's a drooling idiot practically on the stand.
Well, my experience has been a little bit...
The defense lawyer is going to cross-examine the hell out of the state psychiatrist. He said, "You mean all you did is sat in this room and looked at him, you didn't take him aside for the examination?"
No, I realize.
And the minute he says, "No, you wouldn't let me," and bang, you got a mistrial.
Okay, true.
We had a terrible time in this trial where our psychiatrist couldn't ask him about any of the events, of the day. And trying to get around, of course, you know, the defense and all their questions and stuff, and even some of the questions I would ask our psychiatrists would kind of lead into that. And of course, our psychiatrist probably wanted to answer that question too, you know. And boy, we had a heck of a time making the mm-hmm. testimony come out anywhere near coherent, and without bringing out that he tried to ask him these questions and couldn't. And
what did the jury do?
On this one, they convicted.
Same.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
but this was a situation.
Here's some experience after Shepard. The fact that the jury isn't necessarily going to find a guy insane simply because the psychiatrist can't ask him what obviously is essential to a psychiatrist's conclusion with respect to his examination, that is, what happened on the day as directly involved.
In fact, it may have even been to the defendant's advantage, really, to have been able to tell the psychiatrist some of his feelings as he killed the girl, and you know, leading right up to this anger thing that he had, if he did, it may have been to his advantage. What we had fairly decent physical facts, and that's about the only way that the state can get by whenever the defendant comes up with insanity. Anyways, that usually you've got physical facts that show that the guy knew dang well what he was doing. What he was doing was wrong.
Well, what is the...
That's what happened in Massachusetts.
They
showed premeditation all the way.
Section 7.
Well, I... as long as we want to make a motion, I would move to... strike Section 2 of Section 7.
I'll second the motion.
You're moving to strike all of Section 2?
Yeah, that's what my motion is.
I think that would make John Burns happy, because he did feel that wasn't that not correct in that, Don, that he didn't like the stating any of this because mm-hmm. of the fact he wanted to leave it open.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. his feeling was
yeah.
that...
Well, I don't object, certainly, not being a non-voting member, but I still...
The defendant's rights are going to be protected by the court, anyway, in this area. And but if we go farther... or further than the court requires, we've got it written into the code.
Yeah.
Even though the court wouldn't say this was required, if it's a law and statutorily, then we're stuck with it.
I think that under Shepard, clearly, and they said that the defendant does not have to talk, about this that's going to incriminate him. He doesn't have to, and if his attorney certainly is going to instruct him not to. And maybe it would be good evidence if his attorney instructed him not to and he went right ahead and talked about it. Maybe that shows he's insane.
Well, it's a serious question. Can a guy who's in an insanity hearing waive his right?
Yeah.
Or in an incompetency hearing? There's a terrible kind of a funny problem there. If he is, in fact, incompetent, how in the hell can he waive anything? Well, I'm not going to worry about that because that's sort of chasing your tail.
Yeah.
But what... any further discussion on the motion to delete subsection 2 in its entirety?
Yeah, I'd like to serve notice on the subcommittee that I intend to write a law review article and blow the whistle on you guys.
All right, Judge.
I'll make a comment.
I'm on your list.
I'm in favor of the motion, but I'm going to come back, I think, and make a motion also. We take out all of section 7 that's remaining.
I think that's a good idea, too. If you're going to take out 2, I don't see why you can't throw out 1.
What then would be the situation when the state sought to have a psychiatrist examine the defendant?
Well, first of all, I think that if it's going to be meaningful at all, it's probably going to be done on stipulation. This is the one time I've been involved in this. We did this. We stipulated with the state. We got together the DA and picked out a psychiatrist. It was an indigent case, of course, and the court was paying for it. We ended up, he was sane, and he entered a plea. There was no question about the fact that he had killed. It was a homicide. It was to a lesser degree, but it worked. I don't think there's any practical effect that the state's examination is going to do one bit of good.
get an awful argument on that from the deputy. Deputies in the George Van Hoonen's office.
Yeah, I
try these cases.
I think that us at least getting advantage, like I said on this one, that at least having being able to have our psychiatrist have talked to the guy.
But you have no idea that he will talk to him.
Yeah, but I agree with Frank, yeah. I think. If in fact the defendant wants to talk to him, then he can.
Mm-hmm. If he wants to, he can take the right away entirely.
You don't even get that opportunity, I suppose, in a formal way.
But you see, like,
we are prohibiting
before,
from having
before
an
the Phillips
we're
case,
the state from forcing an examination.
But before the Phillips case, like I say, we down there, we're not in a lot of counties around, they were able to get their examination with no problem. The only way that we could get an examination is where was by stipulation is to, you know, we could have them examined. So in some counties, they did it under the premise that if when a defendant files his notice of his intent to show insanity, that then this automatically raises a question to the court as to his competency, so he should be committed to the state hospital to determine his competency. That's the way it was done in some counties. That's the way the state got their examination, is by, you know, having them sent to the state hospital under that.
I mean, that was the raising the defense of insanity at the time that the act took place?
Mm-hmm. Raised a question as far as his competency to
citizens.
But our judge ruled that that was something that his competency was something that the defense had to raise, so that a guy could sit there incompetent as hell, and unless the defense raised it, the judge, you know, didn't have authority to send him. But the only thing that worried me about not putting it in at all is whether this would impliedly mean that by not putting it in there, we're overruling the Phillips case, and to where some judge can say, well, then they've handled this matter, they've brought in, they didn't say anything about an examination by the state, so that I now no longer have authority to order it.
Of course, you think Phillips is long for this world anyway.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I felt that way at the commission meeting, that if we ought to do away with anything, it'd be Phillips. But I don't find the right of the state to have the initial forced examination. I don't find that. I don't object to that, as long as it's tied to a Fifth Amendment restriction. And I think that by removing the language with respect to the Fifth Amendment, doesn't do away with the existing facts, whatever they are.
Yeah.
So I'm satisfied. I would add that John Burns brought up the very point about if we delete this, we ought to make it, he felt, legislative history that we are not changing the policy of Phillips. We ought to say this somewhere in our comment, that the commission does not intend by this, by considering it and then taking it back out, to overrule the effect of Phillips. Now, am I correct
in
that?
No, it's...
I recall
that's
that.
That's what he said, yeah.
Because he didn't want to put either one of these in, I don't think. He wanted to just remain silent about both of the subjects.
I can't see where we're impliedly overruling a decision by not including it in the draft.
Well, it might be in the sense that you had it in and then taking it out.
Yeah, I agree that it's not too convincing, Dave. Some
nuts can
make a
try
to argue it, and I think that our Supreme Court's going to pay a lot of attention to the legislative history of this particular work, and they might be convinced, without some kind of specific language, that maybe the commission did intend to change that rule by its inaction.
It seems to me that some value apart from this question of whether the state should have a shot at him or not within the limits of Shepherd versus Bull. You have some valuable language in here, requires the state to file notice and the court can then order him committed to a suitable facility and so on, enabling language. Maybe a court would figure it had that power.
Well,
and you have some good language in here for the defendant too.
Right, and that's Bruce Spaulding was very much interested in the language about getting the psychiatrist changed if the defendant didn't like him. And
yeah.
I think he's got a good point. It's certainly...
Well, I do, too.
It's a fair
one
guy in
Portland
there.
Particular that, frankly, I don't think is worth a hill of beans as a psychiatrist. The state uses him quite frequently. And And frankly, the reason they use him is he comes up with the right answers all the time. Frankly, if I were ever in a position representing a defendant and had something like this, I'd holler like the devil about it. Simply because I don't feel he's a capable guy at all. There are thoroughly incapable psychiatrists, mm-hmm. just like there are orthopods and judges and so on.
I don't want to suggest that this is true in Oregon, but my studies, and in fact talking to a couple of psychiatrists here in Oregon, indicate that usually the less competent of the psychiatrists are the ones who are in court. That's a terrible generalization, and I don't want to apply it to anybody that you might know. But because most psychiatrists realize their own shortcomings and then have a great distaste for testifying in court. And perhaps those are the better ones who realize their limitations.
What about the defense the state having a right to object to the state the defendant's psychiatrist?
Well, how long it takes that to come up?
Well, not quite the same, though. This is a forced exam.
Any further discussion on the motion to delete subsection 2? Any other question? All those in favor of the motion of Frank Knight to delete subsection 2 in its entirety, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay.
Chairman, just to be consistent, I would move that we delete the balance of section 7.
Is there a second for the motion?
That's section 1.
Sub 1.
I'm not sure whether our rules require a second,
do they?
I don't think they require a second in subcommittee.
Didn't we decide that there was a lot of important language in here that really doesn't hurt anything, though?
Well, I intend to vote against it if I have a vote. Any further discussion on the motion to delete subsection 1? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Let's have a show of hands. All those in favor? All those against?
3-2 tie. So it failed.
Now you're cheering just to break the tie. Go ahead.
Failed by a tie. Would anyone care to consider the suggestion I made of a change in language, or do we need a motion on that? As the dramatic change made in the underlying part.
Oh, I see.
If the defendant, what was it?
So it reads, if the defendant objects to the charge as chosen by the state, the court, for good cause shown, may direct the state to select the charge. Any objection to that change being made? If not, it will be made.
I'll also change the delete subparagraph 1, the number 1, also the technical change.
All right, now we get to section 10.
Yeah, this section was not sent back by the commission. It didn't really examine the language. There's no policy problems with it. I don't think we didn't reach policy on it. But I found, on rereading it closely, I felt that the changes that I made are necessary just as a matter of grammar or to clarify what the section really intends to do. It doesn't change the policy in any way from the original draft, except that some of you now reading it may, in what I think is a clearer draft, may find objections to it. I hope you don't. I think this section is the heart of the procedural part of insanity.
You might just review it, George. The difference between 1, 2, and 3. Or the difference in them.
Well, I'm not sure I can do it by reference to the numbers. I'm a little cold on it.
But,
in general, it provides for flexibility of commitment in that the judge, instead of having to commit to a finding of dangerousness, may commit to the community, for instance, and outpatient control, or he may commit to the state hospital, or there may be a combination where he's committed to the state hospital and then released on a hearing later to the community, or vice versa, so that he isn't locked in one particular place. Now, the There is no existing language in our statutes for the defendant to raise the issue where the hospital itself refuses to find that he's returned to sanity or he's no longer dangerous. And the procedures are set out here with allocation of burden of the proof following the one who's trying to make the point. That is, if the state denies the psychiatrist in the hospital when it recommends release, then the state must have the burden of proof of showing that he still should be kept there. But if the defendant, having been refused release by the hospital, applies himself, then he has the burden of proof of showing he should get out. That has never been clear, and I think that's a sort of a fair allocation of the burden. The dangerous case, then, is going to be, when he's trying to get out himself, is going to have the heavier share to prove. And I think the converse is true. If the state thinks he's all right, then that is, the hospital thinks he's all right, and the state opposes it, the state ought to prove that he should remain there. Now, there's a 5-year limit on the commitment. That is, there's an automatic review, whether or not there's been a review in between for any reason. At the end of 5 years, the hospital, if he is in the hospital, has to notify the court, and a hearing must follow then on release. And if he's still dangerous, if he's still found to be dangerous, he may be put back into the hospital indefinitely, forever, as far as that goes. Now, which means that you don't get out at the end of 5 years, but you can get out if for some reason you've been in there and the hospital has been keeping you in there when they shouldn't have. Now, there are distinctions made here in this section for the first time in Oregon. I can't remember the case now, but anyhow, a case is held. I wish I could remember. It's a fairly recent case. It's cited in here somewhere.
In the commentary.
What's the name of it?
To the earlier.
At any rate, the holding was on the it was a habeas corpus proceeding where the hospital Newton versus Brooks, where the hospital had refused to discharge the defendant. Let's see. Now I'm cold again.
The burden was on the inmate to show that he was.
Oh yeah,
he showed
he was sane within the McNaughton rule, and our court held that that's not enough. That the dangerousness is the issue. So therefore, we have what I believe is a draconian requirement that you've got to show not only that you're not dangerous, but also that you're sane. Now that's unnecessary, and I think the psychiatrists have agreed with that. If in fact you may be insane within the McNaughton rule still, but are found to be not dangerous, if you convince the court you're not dangerous, there's no reason why you should be kept in the hospital. It does no good. It serves no purpose except to take up some beds. So the petty check passer is going to be put back in society because he's not dangerous to the person of himself or anyone else. Now this is assuming a valid medical judgment that a court has got to believe. A court's got to believe this. Not just the doctor. You can't do this on a doctor's say-so, which is another important difference in this one. If, in fact, then we have a person who is insane within McNaughton, but within all reasonable judgment of the court based on the psychiatric examinations, he is not dangerous to himself or the person of others, then he ought to be released into the community, although he may pass some checks. Now that's just an example. I'm sure you'll find check passers who are dangerous to persons, but there are a class of criminals that generally are viewed as not dangerous, just in the particular class they're in. Well, all that is in this section, and I suppose that doesn't tell you some of the procedure, the actual technical procedures involved, but I think I've summed up what this is all about.
Well, now,
this reflects pretty much the California suggestions.
There was another thing that we talked about. You had this procedure in there by the defendant can petition. Now, I know we had a discussion as to limiting the number of times or length of time in which he can petition. How did you take care of that?
Now, I did insert that as directed. That is a change. You're right. And the commission directed 6 months, and that's now in here.
The what?
It's not 6 months. That was the direction to me for redrafting, and it's in here. I wish I could find it quickly.
Application under subsection B shall not be filed oftener than once every 6 months. Sir,
what is the nature of this beast? Is it a civil commitment or a criminal commitment?
Well, this takes the place of the present law that following not guilty by reason of insanity finding or verdict, the court commits or discharge. And that's the end of it, as far as the court's function. From then on, it is entirely up to the state hospital.
Yeah. Is that a criminal commitment or a civil commitment?
It's not under the civil commitment statute. It's under the 136-150, which is the criminal, I think it's 136-150.
The language is different because...
Or 390.
Dr. Jensen, I have...
Ordinary civil commitment, the test is he mentally ill and in need of care and treatment? And that there's a different test when he's found not guilty by reason of insanity.
And dangerousness is the word that's different from the civil commitment.
Well, what does this do that we don't currently do then?
Well, it's entirely up to the state hospital. And they can either spring him in 6 months or forget him.
Well, and this gives him a right to at least raise the issue.
The court makes the decision.
Yeah.
The court
makes a big change.
Yeah, but the state or the defense can raise the issue then.
Yeah, that's right. Of course, the defense can raise it by habeas corpus now, but it's a very cumbersome procedure, and this builds in a more flexible procedure for petition within the existing statute.
This would not... my judgment, do away with habeas corpus.
No, it will not.
You habeas corpus every there. 6 months or every 6 days.
Yeah, but right. Yes, you could now.
So well, they need control of the court as to when this guy's going to be discharged.
Yeah, that's crucial.
Not to the state hospital.
I'd like to,
of course,
a little
George
sideline.
George has real concern, though, that the state hospital gets some check writer up there and keeps him there, you know, the rest of his life.
Yeah, I hate to call me a sob sister because I really don't feel like one.
Well, but I mean, I don't think George understands the practicality of how they operate up there at the state hospital. They don't keep anybody there.
I'm aware. You're right. My practical experience is limited. I'm an ivory tower man predominantly, but my exposure to some of the psychiatrists in the practice here is that the hospital wants to get rid of them as quick as they can. They come in one day and go out the next. And that's not good. This will allow the court, representing the community, to decide whether in fact the hospital ought to be fooling around like that.
This I agree
with. Just to give you an example, you'll remember that when we asked Dr. Levin about this, he didn't have any figures to give us and couldn't tell us other than he said generally he thought about 6 months. Last August, I sent a lady to the state hospital following a not guilty by reason of insanity finding. She had done in her 2-year-old daughter and tried to do in her 6- and 7-year-old sons, but did not succeed, although she cut them both up liberally. In October of 1967, she was then committed for ability to assist and so on, and was finally found able to assist last August. We tried the whole case in half an hour, and everybody agreed she was she was insane at the time. So she was sent back to the state hospital, and I emphasized very strongly, in both orally and in the letter, that I felt it was imperative that this gal be watched. I got a letter the other day stating that they were getting ready to let her come back to the community on a trial visit status. And frankly, I wasn't really too concerned about that, but the thing that did bother me is that there was nothing in the letter concerning the whereabouts of her children and so on. Well, I immediately undertook to find out, and fortunately got a protective order issued through Judge Lewis that the children who are now staying with a grandmother cannot be visited except under supervision by a counselor and so on. But while they paid me the unusual courtesy of letting me know ahead of time they were going to do it, there was no thought at all, at least as far as the letter indicated, there was no thought at all of danger to her children. Now, I'm not scared about the gal. She's not dangerous to me. I see that she could be, but very definitely she'd be a danger to a child. And there, this is from August to March. So 6 months, away she go. And that girl was just as sick as they make them. You can't convince me that... Although medically they say she's well enough to be... She's responded well to treatment and psychotherapy and so on and so forth, and she's ready for a trial visit. Well, okay, but
Well, here's a beautiful contrast. The reason that Dr. Trelevin and others have indicated that the long confinements, where they are long, invariably result from the incompetency here. And of course, the reason is that the hospital can't let them go. The person who's been declared incompetent and confined can only be declared competent by the court. And obviously, the court has to determine that himself. Well, right here we have a parallel, I think, where the state can decide, where the hospital can decide itself whether to let the person go. There's a short confinement, so therefore the period of confinement is not relevant except to the point of who discharges. And I think the court, and I think we've all pretty well agreed along, including the psychiatrist, almost unanimously.
Well, I was going to
say the court should make this decision, not the superintendent.
Section 10 was the one section in this draft that all of the psychiatrists agreed on at the commission meeting, including Dr. Hogan.
There's an interesting sidelight. We discussed in the hall one day, and I don't want to commit him to a view, but I knew that he was one of the principal opponents of the ALI enactment of the insanity defense. He got Hatfield, I guess more than anybody, to veto the what we are now recommending again as the insanity defense, because he felt it was too liberal and there'd be people running around because there was a control test in it and there'd be too many people on the street. And I talked to him about it later. And I said, do you still feel the same way about the ALI test? And he said, no, he didn't. He said he didn't think he'd oppose it now because the court in this draft is making the decision on discharge. And that's what makes him more friendly to a more liberal defense. If in fact people are going to get into the hospital more often, at least the court now is going to say when they get back out.
I have two or three.
I don't think they'll get in more often either.
Suggestions on this, George, that I think are essentially procedural or grammatical. I don't want to take too much time because I know that the committee originally approved the thrust of it, and so did the commission. But do you see any problem at all, George, in subsection 1 that there's no explicit allocation of the burden? Now, there hasn't been up to this time, in the present statute, there's no burden spoken of. I'm somewhat concerned, though, that when we talk about allocation of the burden in the subsection 2 and subsection 3, whether or not it might be well
Well, I think you're absolutely right.
Well, rather than get an answer from you, I thought I would just raise that and have you give some thought to it, and then
I can tell you right now what I would suggest, that the state have the burden of commitment.
Why don't the defendant
have the burden of proving that he shouldn't be committed. Now, that's my reaction. That's a philosophical reaction, and I would draft it along that line.
I wonder if...
I don't think you'd agree with me, frankly. I think subcommittee would probably disagree.
Well, rather than make it...
I'm with you, George. Stick together.
Rather than make a determination of it, would there be any chance you might take a quick look at some of the other states and see if there is... maybe we don't need it. We haven't had it up to now, but to the extent that we're allocating burdens under 2 and 3, maybe it's a good idea to talk of it here. Subsection 2, we talk about release on supervision, and I wonder, did we ever come to any conclusion as to who would do the supervising, or did we leave that
open?
We discussed it in the subcommittee about that, and I think we decided it was best to not say anything as to who would do this.
If there's somebody available
that
would take it, then the court can do it. If there's nobody available to take it, the court obviously can't do it. You'll recall the reason was that I think you suggested the objection to it. Yeah, they'd have to have money and all kinds of authority themselves that we didn't want to get into. But if in fact they get it some way or are interested in it and are capable of doing it, then the judge under this could do it.
Now,
so we're not trying to outrun the existing facilities.
When we say the person who's not a danger to himself or to the person of others, do we make it clear that we feel that that an arsonist and this type of thing is a danger to others, the person of others?
Well, as I recall in the commentary, we talked about this. What we're talking about is
I think my answer would be yes. If the medical testimony supports that and the judge believes it, naturally.
Now, like,
but this arsonist is very, very obviously dangerous to persons.
But now, like, and is a burglar.
I don't know that much about
I think under this, a burglar could not, who's found not guilty by reason of insanity, could not be committed.
Well, dangerous, he could. It's not, I don't think the question is what kind of a crime it is, it's what kind of a person he is. A check passer might be extremely dangerous in my example.
Well, yeah, I mean,
he may be a danger to himself and
he may have been writing a check to buy the gun or something.
That's right.
But
that's right.
I mean,
he could
that type of thing. But
I think it'd be up to the court, and I think it'd depend on what his past history was, and if his mental troubles accompanied past crimes which involve violence or
it's quite possible, I think, that what I've read, not only just psychiatric testimony things, but it's possible that a murderer would be found not dangerous. That the act of killing discharges the problems that the guy has and he'd be just as safe back in society as you and me. So you can't necessarily look to the crime, of the specific crime. This has been one of the problems with defining the word dangerous. Look at the pattern of his life, kind of crimes he's committed, and a whole array of things to decide. At least the doctors have to look at that and then make a recommendation to the court, and he can say, I don't believe any of you, this guy's dangerous, and he's going to the hospital.
I have a couple of other questions, George, on subsection A of section 2, which subsection A provides the intermediate order during the 5 years where he's been released on supervision. And in effect, you say there that during the 5 year period, they can have a hearing, and they can either continue him on further supervision or you can commit him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your first sentence, at any time within 5 years of the original entry and so forth, the court may, upon notice to prosecution and such person, conduct a hearing and so on to determine. Who would initiate that?
It's the same problem again with one, isn't it? Yeah, I think
in other
you're
words,
right.
Mm-hmm. Should we be explicit there that, well, let us say, upon motion of the supervisory agency or something like that? I don't know. I suppose the way it's worded, that the court can go ahead and do it. It occurred to me, though, that somebody has to start initiating it, and I don't know whether it be an order to show cause by the court or what.
Well,
this is essentially a drafting thing, it isn't a policy.
Well, let me ask you, as a member of the court, now this is your order. You've ordered this fellow released to the community, so he's within your control. Is it really necessary to formalize who can bring it? Obviously, the only person that would want to bring it would be some supervising agency, and there may not even be any.
Or the person committed himself would be, I think, the most likely to.
He could
ask for a change.
If it is a practical problem, I'd certainly want to address some correction. But could it be done informally just as well?
Fine. Okay. I've just raised it. I'm not sure there's a problem. Yeah. I think you've answered it. Okay. Now, in the second sentence, you say, if the court determines that the person is affected by mental disease or defect, the court may release him on further supervision and so on. I would prefer the language continues to be affected, but that's merely grammar. But the thing that disturbs me about that is that in the first part of subsection 2, the reason that you supervise him is if he is affected by mental disease and presents a substantial danger, but can be adequately controlled under supervision. Now, but the test here of releasing on further supervision is a different test because it simply calls mm-hmm. for if he's affected by mental disease or defect. Mm-hmm. Should we not make that harmonious?
Yeah, I think so. Here is a place, actually what I've done with my redrafting was try to pick up exactly that kind of reference in several places, and I missed it here. It should also repeat again the original
he continues
grounds.
To be
that's right.
affected by the
right.
disease and continues to be dangerous,
continues
but,
to be affected
but is capable
and
of
continues.
And so on.
Yeah, you're correct. The in drafting, technically correct, you have to say that. Otherwise, it's ambiguous.
Then, section B, subsection B, provides that the supervised person may apply to the circuit court of the county in which he is confined, or of the county from which he is committed, upon his petition for discharge from or modification of an order upon which he was released on supervision, and so on. In other words, he can get off of supervision. That's mm-hmm. subsection B, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, why do we have it possible to go to different counties?
Yeah. I don't know, frankly. This troubles me, but I left it here hoping that it would either that you would raise the issue if it is a problem.
Well,
I don't know if it's
words,
a problem.
In other words, if I put a guy on supervision and I say, okay, you can be in Salem,
mm-hmm.
That's where his home is, let's say, or his job. You can be in Salem and you have to take outpatient treatment and so forth and so on. Then he feels that he's entitled to a modification or release from the supervision order. Why should he go to Val Sloper? Mm-hmm. Sloper doesn't know anything about it.
No, he should always
neither
go back to the court.
Okay.
All right, let's see now. All I have to do is delete a phrase.
Yeah, and why should Gortmaker, who doesn't know anything more about it, be the district attorney who's received notice?
Should be
it
Van
should
Humus.
Yeah.
Right. And in other words, it seems to me that as long as you're going to leave the, as long as you're going to have judicial control.
So we want to refer to the court from which he's committed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, by the way, would be true in
yeah, that it's repeated. I know.
Subsection A and B of section 3.
Yes. I'll repair that.
Because this would have everybody applying for release from the state hospital
yeah.
going through the Marion County Circuit Courts rather than...
And then, similarly...
Maybe we could put down some, come down to Corvallis to spread it around.
We don't want them down there.
Yeah, put in there.
Apply to this similarly, in subsection
yeah.
2, on page 4, about the fifth line, you've got... Where there's a hearing on application for a discharge, you say it shall be on notice to the district attorney and the probation officer of the county in which the application is filed. Now, since we haven't really spoken to the probation officer, that is...
That's out, right.
Could you say the supervisory officer?
Yes, I think that would be more appropriate. We did start out with the word probate,
yes,
and I just simply missed it again
yeah.
here. Wait a minute, let's see now. Am I correct in looking again at that very same sentence we were just correcting? Where the hearing on an application for discharge or modification shall be held on the notice to the district attorney of the county from which confinement is ordered. Isn't that it again? I've got to change that
yeah.
also.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Is there any problem at all maybe in naming institutions? Now, they've done that in the penal code, too, where they name the Oregon State Penitentiary or the Oregon State Correctional Institutions rather than saying the Department of Corrections. Does that create any problems at all?
Well, I think we talked about this earlier, that ultimately, when we get to the final wrap-up, we may well want to avoid that usage of specific institutions, because there may be flexibility in the situation of confinement that would be available. But as I recall, when we mentioned earlier, we thought we'd leave it open until we didn't we do that?
Yeah, then? I think that's right.
Fine.
That we were going to stay with these specific terms.
That's fine.
For the time being.
What it amounts to, Don, is that after we get through with the code, the commission has approved the code, then Don gets to go through and rewrite it the way he wants it to be.
I see. Good.
It's part of the wrap-up.
I had a few minor changes here.
With you. That's
fine. A few editorial changes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, those are the...
Yeah, those are all excellent suggestions.
Anybody else want this stuff?
Don, I have one more thought about the... About this, this is a long, long section, and I spent many years as a legislative draftsman in the kind of office like we have up over in the other building. And one of the banes of a legislative counsel's office is a long section when it comes to amending it, because, as you probably all know, certainly you know, the whole thing has to be set out if you need to change one word. And I thought about that, and I've looked at this section, and I suppose it could be broken down into sections. It would involve perhaps some very intricate references back and forth in Section 3 and Section 6, with the always the possibility of printer's mistakes and later inserted sections gumming up the thing. I don't know what you want to do.
Where are you now?
The same long section I've just been looking at. Its length it can be a problem, and this is really a no problem with the legislature. It's a problem of the people that might have to be tinkering in the innards of this thing when the legislature wants to make a policy change. Now, should we worry about something like that, or do you feel
that
we ought to leave it alone?
I think you could do this, George. You could say in Section 10, you could make Section 10 one section, simply the first paragraph, and have it recite, make an order in accordance with sections 11, 12, and 13, and then break down 1, 2, and 3. Now that would partly be...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could work it out. It's not an impossibility, but I don't know. I had kind of mixed feelings about it, because it is such a coherent situation. It is a highly interrelated procedure. Should we worry about that, Don, or you want to do it when
we're
all through?
Well, I think... it's where the problem, of course, would arise is any subsequent amendments once it's enacted in the law. That's of course that's a mechanical problem, and certainly from the standpoint of legislative drafting, although you try to avoid these kind of problems, there's no rule that I know of that prohibits having a long section.
No. So I kind of have a feeling this may be a situation where it's justified, as much as I hate them.
I mean, you've got it well divided by subsections as far as readability is concerned. That's not going to affect that, I don't think. It would just be from the standpoint of the work involved to make any later amendments to it. I'd say leave it alone at this stage. Bob Lundy might not agree with that, but...
Well, he probably would not, and I think rightfully so. You've got to... Here again, this isn't a policy question at all.
But I think if it's a question of clarity and substance, as opposed to the mechanics of whether it's long or short, I'd go for the clarity. And
well, if there isn't any strong feelings about it, I think I'm tempted to leave it alone.
Any other comments or corrections or suggestions of Section 10?
I'm going to look at this very closely again when I draft this now.
I'm trying
to get these bugs out of it,
sure,
because it is a difficult section.
I'm not sure that I picked up
these. Yeah, I'll look in what you said and look all the way through again.
The same central finding as the release of supervision of confinement.
Right.
How about subsection 11?
Let's see.
As I recall, this one you pruned down because the commission rather felt that the...
yes, we eliminated a couple of...
they felt
nothing is added here,
yeah,
only something is deleted.
There was
just
some repetition.
I think this is a technical correction reflecting the commission's wishes without any policy discussion.
I think this reflected the motion that Dave Frost made at the commission meeting in that particular section.
Essentially, the test of competency to proceed is the same as it is under present law, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
We had it there before.
I had some more matter in there that was perhaps repetitious.
Then we've got this section 12.
Yes, now, let me see.
Is section 11 essentially what we have now then?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm trying. The reason I'm hesitating is that what I want to say is that this reflects commission directions without any changes on my part. But I want to make sure of that. If I stuck some ideas into my own, I want to be sure that I tell you about that. So, maybe just for a second.
Is it necessary in Section 12 to, when we're talking about the superintendent of the state hospital designating the psychiatrist, to have the words "which designation may be" or "include himself"?
Where are you,
that's
Dave?
What I'm wondering about, because usually they do this by boards up there, don't they? I mean,
Section 12,
yeah.
Which designation may be to include himself.
Well, that's present language in the statute, and I left it there because it's in the statute now, and I saw no reason to take it out, but I have no objection if you want to take it out.
I would think it's unnecessary, but it's nothing momentous, certainly.
I know, for instance, in subparagraph 3, the insert there was, that reflects exactly what the commission directed. Subparagraph B of sub 3 reflects also the direction of the commission. Now, I'm trying to remember about this, all this underlined material, and I'm coming up blank so far.
Well, we talked about this section along with the earlier section, the Shepherd versus Bowe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. I think this reflects what the commission, the policy of the subcommittee and the commission also. That because the reason was that if you, now as a practical matter, the reason why you ask for an incompetency hearing for a defendant, for the defense, is to get an insanity ruling, and the state also does this sometimes. And this is improper in light of Shepherd versus Bowe, since the two issues are not the same. Trying to reflect that in this language.
Well, here again, we
and here again, I've stuck in an idea of my own. This is the idea of my own now. This will have to come out because I added this gratuitously after the commission hearings and following my research into the philosophy of the Fifth Amendment, which you have already disagreed with. So I think automatically there ought to be stricken. That paragraph and then. Beginning during the examination.
Well, this would really cause a problem when they're sent up there to the state hospital to have the attorney and their psychiatrist come trotting down.
Some defendant is going to nail you to that, though, I think. My prediction is, as Drew Pearson used to say, that that's...
Which it proves. 77%.
Yeah. Well, is the first part all right? The report shall not contain any findings.
Going back even a little higher than that, in the sub 3.
Okay.
I wonder, I personally would rather see this specifically limited to these three things. The new wording, but is not necessarily limited to. In other words, just we're asking for an opinion as to competence. We're putting ultimate faith in the superintendent.
Well,
why don't we just come back with an ultimate conclusion? He is or is not.
Well, my only answer is that I was under direction of the commission to specifically put that in. Here I'm not taking issue with you at all. I'm just explaining why it's there. The commission felt that ought to be there by form of motion.
I think the reason they felt that way was that they wanted to be sure that these things were included, that this would be a guideline to the psychiatrist, but at the same time they weren't trying to tie their hands, and because they all said that, well, we would put these things into our report anyway.
Psychiatrist said that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
what?
That we were just concerned that this was in their report, whatever else was in there, that this was in there, but we weren't trying to... And I think that this was a commission action in deference to what the psychiatrist had to say about...
And the paragraph prohibiting the insanity stuff does tie their hands. The court doesn't want to be informed about that.
Yeah.
Stick to the competency issues.
Well, this is a pretty touchy stage of the proceedings, and we're having a report filed in triplicate, which, is, of course, the prosecution will have as well as the defense.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's all we're talking about is the ultimate question of competency alone as far as proceeding with the trial, I would sure hate to have a report that threw in a few gratuitous comments about statements made during the examination.
Well,
and I think it's possible. I think you could taint the whole proceedings from that point on.
Precisely.
But I don't see why we can't.
I feel separate applies here.
Yeah. I don't know why we can't specifically say it shall include only.
No,
a description, a statement, and a conclusion.
I think what happens is that usually, at least in many counties, I think what happens when you have this kind of an examination, they do the other two.
Oh, both together?
They do them both together.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that you don't have one on this, and then if they decide that he's fit to proceed, then have a separate one to determine whether he was insane at the time of the commission of the action.
And there's a very good reason for that, because not only is, let us say, the very narrowly selfish standpoint of the defendant, but from the standpoint of, you know, there's a lot of defense lawyers that don't want to just go around wasting the county's money, and all these guys, nearly all these guys, are innocent. So he gets him down to Salem for, or not the Buttes, but actually for a competency examination. He can get a look at whether or not he wants to plead insanity in the same boat, and determine what he wants to do with that.
Does this tie back in with our section 10?
Well,
because it's a little different procedure.
Yeah, sure.
We've got different psychiatrists, probably, I would think, designated by the prosecution for an examination than you would have.
Oh no!
By the superintendent.
No.
Is this what you're talking about?
No,
no.
Oh, okay.
Defense lawyer says, I'm not sure he's able to understand, and so on. What he's really saying is, I want to get a look at what the psychiatrist will say about.
Okay. I got you.
Okay. Now,
I think that point changes my approach.
It's very frequently done.
I just remembered.
Very frequently done. And these, George, these figures I've talked to you about that I'm working up show that I would say generally at least half of the time, I could be mistaken here, but
yeah, please.
30 to 40, maybe 50% of the time, both aspects will be requested by the defendant himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know from our standpoint, when I say our now, I'm talking about the court, you would very sizably increase the expense to Multnomah County because the budget just gone out of sight on these things already. $60,000 a year we spend.
You mean this is a real property tax relief measure? So sick of them.
Well, you know, what happened?
Mess.
We found out that it was costing Multnomah County, I forget the figures, it was either $355 or $455.
$455 per
case. And most of that was for board and room down Salem that the state bills the county for. So we got wise to that, and except in the exceptional cases, now we don't send them down to Salem anymore because we can get Ivor Campbell do it for $50, you know, but even a lot of guys are $50, $75, or $100, and that's it. That's all it costs.
I don't think that $455, whatever it is, includes the transportation costs and personnel the sheriff's also may have.
Yeah, apart from all that.
Yeah.
Apart from that.
Very expensive.
This is just the part that hits the circuit court.
Yeah.
But it's gone up tremendously. But really, if you put this in, you're going to very directly increase the cost of maybe 50%, maybe nearly 100%. I'm not sure.
You mean because now in addition to sending them to see the psychiatrist for this issue, they have to send them back again, and doubles the time and doubles the bill.